This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Taking a walk.
You still feel their spirit here. You know, some people say it almost feels like Louis and Lucia, maybe they're grocery shopping right now. Maybe they're having lunch and we're just kind of, you know, keeping the house warm until they get back. But the living room, very musical room. Above the piano, there's a pencil sketch of Toscanini, the great classical conductor. There's a Leroy Neiman painting of Jerry Mulligan, the great baritone saxophonist. Louis himself saw that at Hammer Galleries in the early 1960s and carried it all the way back here to Corona.
Welcome to the Taking a Walk podcast with your host, Buzz Knight. On past episodes, Buzz has walked through the Country Music Hall of Fame and the Folk Americana Hall as well. And on this episode, he heads to Corona, Queens, New York, to the Louis Armstrong House Museum with Ricky Riccardi, the Director of Research Collections. You'll love this take on a national treasure. Next, with Taking a Walk and Buzz Knight.
Well, Ricky, thanks for taking a walk with me. I'm so thrilled to be here.
It is a beautiful day in Corona, and there's nowhere else I'd rather be, and no one else I'd rather be with, Buzz. This should be fun.
And I consider myself very lucky as I was making the trip out here to be doing what I'm doing. And I think you, in your career, feel the same way.
I would say so, yeah. I mean, I've been a Louis Armstrong fan since the age of 15, which was 28 years ago. And we are about to walk through the front door of Louis Armstrong's house, where I have been working for the last 14 years.
This is magical.
It almost sounds like he's practicing upstairs.
Look at this.
So yeah, right now we're in the living room of the Armstrong house, and everything is pretty much as is. You know, no one has lived here since Louis and Lucille Armstrong. And right off the bat, you know, Lucille, the beautiful Mrs. Armstrong, Lady Armstrong, her nickname is Brown Sugar. She's there to greet us. And we would not be here without Lucille Armstrong. She was the fourth Mrs. Armstrong, which is a subject for a whole different interview. But Lucille and Louis, they married in October 1942. And their honeymoon was 5 straight months of one-nighters. And Lucille said, this is not what I signed up for. And so she had spent part of her childhood in Corona. And she was living in the Bronx at that time, but she was friends with the Geraldo family next door. They told her the house was for sale, 3456. And I'm going to let Lucille tell you what happened next.
And I told Louis, let's get a house.
because I was raised in a house always, you know. I've always lived in the suburbs. So I asked Louis, and he said, what do you want a house for? We'll be traveling. I'll get a hotel room. And I wasn't about to be cooped up in a hotel room. And so I said, this guy doesn't know what the house is all about. I bought the house myself and didn't tell him. So I'd had the house 8 months before I told Louis. 8 whole months. So finally I told him 2 weeks before we were to go back to New York, and I told him, I said, Pops, I got something to tell you. So he said, well, now what have you done now? I said, well, I haven't done anything. I don't think you're going to be unhappy about what I've done. So I said, yes, I bought a house in an old town called Corona. He had never heard of Corona, and I had come from Corona. And I said, well, why did you pay for it? You didn't ask me for any money. I said, but you have to remember that I had been working for 13 years. I had a little money saved up, and so when I approached you about a house and you were so down on it, I didn't ask you, and I just took my money and I put the down payment on the house, and I've been keeping the payments up. So he said, you have? I said, yes. I said, but now that you know about the house, you can take the payments over.
So the asking price in March 1943 was $8,000. So I think the mortgage payments were about $25 a month. Oh, man.
That is amazing. I love that story. That is so brilliant. It reminded me, I have to say, a little bit of my mother, who wanted to get a particular bedroom set, and my father would have nothing to do with it. She just went and bought it.
Did it herself.
And he slept on the couch for like a month, and they didn't speak, and she said, fine.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. At some point, you just have to go with the flow.
That's beautiful.
And so, yeah, Lucille was a cotton club dancer, so she had a career in show business, but she actually gave it all up to kind of be Mrs. Louis Armstrong. And as much as she loved the house, it didn't hold a candle to how Louis felt about it. The first time he saw it, he actually didn't even believe it was his. The cab driver pulled up, and Armstrong told the cab driver, he goes, oh, man, quit kidding and take me to the address I wrote down here. And so Lucille opened the door and said, come on in. And once he came in, that was it. Because, I mean, his whole childhood was poverty. Living in New Orleans, you know, outhouse in the backyard, no indoor plumbing, barefoot, not knowing where his next meal was going to come from. Then he becomes a star, but he's living out of suitcases, living in hotel rooms, living in apartments. And so this, you know, to have an actual home. And as the years went on, he had enough fame and enough money that he could have lived anywhere, but he refused. This was a working class neighborhood, an integrated neighborhood. There were real people, no celebrities, and lots of kids and all that kind of stuff. And so Louis just fell in love with the neighborhood. Lucille, after a while, she started getting the itch. Maybe we can move to an estate in Long Island or a penthouse in Manhattan. He would not budge. And so the house, the way we see it today, what Lucille would do is she would call her interior decorator every 5 years, and they would start knocking down walls and putting up wallpaper and chandeliers and everything else. And Louis was fine with that. As long, you know, he would go out on tour and come back and be like, uh-oh, you know, this room doesn't look the same. But if that's, you know, happy wife, happy life. So that made Lucille happy. And then she really earned her stripes, you could say, after Louis died, because she was the one who had the house declared a National Historic Landmark. And I found a newspaper clipping from August 20th, 1971. Louis died July 6, 1971. And she's already telling the press, you know, one day I'm going to give the house to the city of New York. And then people from around the world can come and see how Louis lived. And so she sadly didn't live long enough to see it happen, but she kind of gave us the blueprint. And so the house today, the museum across the street, we think she'd be very happy.
Oh, this is fantastic. Wow. I love how it's decorated.
Oh, yeah. We have people who visit who aren't even the biggest jazz fans. They just kind of want to see a perfectly preserved late 60s, early 70s home. You know, yeah. The wallpaper, all the stuff. We get a lot of comments. People come in. They feel like it's their grandparents' house. And you still feel their spirit here. You know, some people say it almost feels like Louis and Lucille, maybe they're grocery shopping right now. Maybe they're having lunch and we're just kind of... You know, keeping the house warm until they get back. But the living room, very musical room. Above the piano, there's a pencil sketch of Toscanini, the great classical conductor. There's a Leroy Neiman painting of Jerry Mulligan, the great baritone saxophonist. Louis himself saw that at Hammer Galleries in the early 1960s and carried it all the way back here to Corona. And then there's all the knickknacks and stuff. Well, everything that they would go out on tour and bring back, you know, gondola from Italy, a vase from France, statue from Africa. So it really is kind of like, you know, the ambassador statue room as well. But for me, I mean, my domain are the archives. So we have the world's largest archives for any single jazz musician. And the crown jewel are these reel-to-reel tapes, where Lewis bought his first tape recorder in 1950. And from December 1950 until the night before he passed away, he made about 750 reel-to-reel tapes. And half of them are mixtapes, where he would just grab records, turn on the radio. He wanted to hear all kinds of music. The other half are the spoken word tapes, where it's just him, Lucille, musicians. Sometimes he's alone. And those, that's the gold. And I'm going to play a clip right now of Lewis and Lucille in this room. You'll hear music on in the background from probably this, you know, this Grundig Majestic stereo console. But Lewis is giving the date in the clip, and Lucille, the helpful wife, is there to correct him.
At home in Cromer, Long Island, New York. February 26, 1956. February 6, 1926. Pardon me, folks. Lucille, you're messing with my eye, you know.
It's a fly in the wall moment. But he has the self-awareness. He says, pardon me, folks. There's nobody in the room with them. And so that's the key to me. We have a tape, which we don't play on tour, where Lewis and Lucille get into a knockdown, drag-out argument. It's like 5 o'clock in the morning. They're both a little tipsy, and they're just going at you, yelling at each other, cursing at each other. Lucille does not know he's recording it. And when she finds out he is, she tells him to erase it. And he says, no, it's for posterity. And to me, it's those two words, for posterity. People ask, why is he making tapes? Why is he making scrapbooks? Why is Lucille keeping the house? They knew. They knew that one day, you know, people who weren't even born yet, like myself, you know, they were going to be interested in Louis Armstrong. And why not be in charge of your own story? You know, Tell your own story in your own words and let the future come to you instead of reading books and trying to piece together the facts. No, he left it all for us. It's a gift.
It is a gift. Fabulous.
Yeah. Wow. So that's the living room. We're going to walk down the hallway here. And the next room is the bathroom. I mentioned growing up in New Orleans, Louis had no indoor plumbing, and so when you see this bathroom, it's kind of like, oh, he's come a long way. We've got mirrors from the floor to the ceiling. We've got gold fixtures everywhere, the gold swans, and it's just like, yeah, that's Lucille and the interior decorator as well. For, you know, from a size perspective, maybe it's a typical Queens bathroom, but then you take one look at it and go, oh no, there's nothing typical about this.
And what is that in the corner of the tub?
Oh, that's probably, I would say, a gigantic bottle of cologne, it looks like.
Yeah.
And we have all the original stuff. That's the amazing thing. The fact that no one's lived here, everything you see, from the colognes upstairs when we go, you'll see Lucille's gloves, all that stuff. You know, it's all laid out. It's just meticulous. We're now entering the dining room. This is where Lewis would eat his favorite meal. Do you know what his favorite meal was?
I don't.
Red beans and rice.
I should have known.
Pure New Orleans food. Lewis used to sign his letters, red beans and rice le yours. And he tells a great story when he was courting Lucille. He said, I took her finely manicured hand, looked her in the eye, and said, can you cook red beans and rice? And so she needed some tips from her mother, but once she cooked it for him, you know, the rest is history. This Asian motif in this room was actually done in Lucille's widowhood, but it's actually kind of neat because she must have found this painting, and the translation we've been told is Heaven on Earth, and it's a painting of a Japanese-style garden, and there's musicians, there's dancers, and sure enough, Lucille being a dancer, Lewis being a musician, and next door to the house, Lewis's last gift to the world, Lewis and Lucille bought an abandoned property and turned it into a Japanese garden. And okay. So that's where we have our outdoor events and concerts and stuff like that. So I think this is kind of summing all of that up. And we do have one more audio clip in this room, and this is Lewis 4 days before he passed away in 1971 saying grace at this very table.
God make us thankful for what we're about to receive. Blessing our bodies for Christ's sake. Amen. I didn't say amen, I said amen.
Sense of humor right to the end. But you can't have a dining room without a kitchen. And this is everybody's favorite room. This kind of all blue, all turquoise, jet age, World's Fair, Jetsons, kind of kitchen of the future. Apparently, this shade of blue was Lucille's favorite. So you got the cabinets, but you also get the clock up there, the Sub-Zero refrigerator, even the dishwasher down here, which I love, has daily use and party mode for when things get out of hand. Lucille loved to keep things streamlined, so you get the can openers mounted on the countertop. You get the blender mounted in over there. Any guesses over in these drawers? There's two hidden drawers. One of them has paper towels, and the other one, tinfoil.
Look at that.
And again, you know, just life of luxury here. These were actually wooden cabinets that were lacquered piano hinges, so a little musical touch there as well. And the Armstrongs were both very short. Louis was 5'6", Lucille was 5'2", but if you notice, there's a chair here that flips over and becomes a stepladder.
Oh, yeah.
So they could reach all the stuff on the higher shelves. And I have to point out the 6-burner stove with a double oven, and this little placard reads, "Custom made by Crown for Mr. and Mrs. Louis Armstrong."
Awesome.
Yeah. Wow. So we've had World of Interiors magazine and all these kind of different non-jazz entities come out, and it's just like they take one look at this kitchen and say, oh my goodness, this is this is it.
And then, of course, we have some bubbly here.
Oh, yeah. No, the champagne is still, you know, still ready to be popped. And this room over here, this little breakfast nook, when they actually moved in, this was a two-family house, and Lucille moved her mother in upstairs. And so Louis and Lucille just stayed to the first floor. And so this was their original bedroom. But eventually they turned it into this little breakfast nook. I hear the doorbell ring, and that means the next tour is coming in. So let's sneak upstairs into the more private side of the house.
Sounds good.
Could not have timed it any more better. Walk past this guest bedroom with the psychedelic motif.
That, yeah.
Where the day bed magically matches the wallpaper on the walls and ceiling.
And that picture is pretty spectacular.
Yes, that was originally on the cover of Life magazine, a Philippe Halsman photo from 1966. This is the bedroom where Armstrong always bragged about his wall-to-wall bed, which is what he called his king-size bed. This is where he passed away, early hours, July 6, 1971. So it's kind of a sacred spot. For Lucille, this was her kind of prayer corner over here. We have her copy of the Bible, a print of Dolly's crucifixion, some religious figurines from around the world. Louis, anytime he was asked about religion, he would say he was raised a Baptist, he wore a Star of David around his neck, and he was good friends with the Pope. So he had all bases covered.
And what is this?
I wish I knew.
Oh, wow.
If it has something to do with Louis, I got you covered. But Lucille's little knickknacks and all, I don't know what we're looking at. It looks like a dog and a couple of young people enjoying a feast.
Yeah.
I'm sure it had, maybe, again, probably something they picked up in their travels. But that's the thing. Up to this point, almost everything we've seen is Lucille's fingerprints.
Right.
Yeah, this is the way she wanted it. Because Louis, for the 40s and 50s into the 60s, he was on the road 300 days a year.
Yeah.
He loved coming back here. But I mean, he was on, you know, he was a road warrior.
Yeah.
But this next room, which is the last room and really the main event of the house, this is all him. This is the den.
Oh, wow.
This is the original man cave. This is where he would make the reel-to-reel tapes. He would design collages. He would cut out news clippings, scotch tape them to the boxes. And then Armstrong had a complete archivist mentality. Every time he made a reel of tape, he would number it, and then he would catalog it. So he would handwrite the contents. DeKalb's TV show, Martin Luther King's funeral, Louis Armstrong's All-Stars. And so, as an archivist, he made my job very easy because he was very thorough that way. And we have some great audio clips here. The first clip is him in 1965 actually showing off this book And then he talks about how Lucille gave him this room, how growing up in New Orleans, they would have slept in a room like this. But then he talks about the importance of listening to all kinds of music, including the Beatles.
I put it index. So I index all the numbers and give them a number. And then Lucille fixed something I never had in my life before. She gave me a room and made a den out of it. You know what I mean? That really knocked me out because we couldn't afford no den in the neighborhood of days. We'd better sleep in that room. Now I got a den. I can look at all my tapes around the walls. And just pick out what I want to hear.
How does it feel?
Well, it's got to feel good. I mean, I don't ask much in life. I mean, those are the needed things. She know that would be my life in music. So when I can hear every record I ever made, all I can do is look in a little book and put my finger on it. My interviews, I got them all on tape. And I buy records. That's why I tell you. That's why I tell you. I buy everybody's records and every interview I have. And every show I do, Ed Sullivan or Belltown, whatever it is, it's a company that sends the whole show on tape at my house.
Oh,
and I index that. You know what I mean? I got the Beatles. I got everybody. And they say, well, what you think about the Beatles? I say, they're great. They got a little beat there. You know what I mean? And it's all right.
They look like
it. Okay, that's all right.
If they only get a haircut.
You see, now we got to be not too partial to one kind of music. You got to appreciate all kind of music.
That's right.
That's what I'm trying to put in your head. Listen to all kind of music.
I love that because when it's guests, you know, they're trying to say, "Oh, if only they, you know, if only the Beatles would get a haircut," you know, that kind of stuff. He doesn't take the bait. He's like, "No, they got a little beat there, and you know, listen to all kinds of music." And he really believed that. We have his record collection in the archives. I mean, you name it: King Oliver and Jelly Roll Morton, of course. But he has Miles Davis, he has Thelonious Monk, he has Frank Sinatra and Perry Como, tons of opera, Enrico Caruso. He would go to South America, bring back tango records, go to Ghana, bring back high life records. So he had huge ears, and we have to have some music in this room. He loved warming up on trumpet in his den while listening to whatever was on his stereo. And so this next clip is him listening to an Italian singer, Ray Martino. And first again, Lewis is addressing us, the imaginary audience, telling us where he is, where he's going. But the Italian pop record has an instrumental interlude, so why not fill it with the sounds of Louis Armstrong's trumpet?
I'm just recording it while I'm just catching. We leave tomorrow night, 11:50, for Miami, Florida, for 2 weeks by plane. This will be my last night home, and I'm spending it talking to you.
So here's the part of the record now. Darling, je vous aime beaucoup.
So beautiful. Oh, I have a smile on my face that is just unbelievable.
That's the goal. Well, so did he. And that's a perfect segue. This painting looking us in the eye right here. Can you read the signature?
Benedetto?
Benedetto. Do you know who that is?
No.
It's an artist, also from Queens, from Astoria, also a singer. Recent.
Tony Bennett.
Tony Bennett, yes. Wow. Tony Bennett painted that for Lewis, gave it to him in London in 1970, and Lewis said, "Man, you out-Rembrandted Rembrandt."
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, they were close friends. I mean, the whole room, everywhere, look, the albums up there. These photos, you know, of course, it's Lewis, Lucille, but there's also some beautiful photos of Lewis and the neighborhood kids. You know, they would come over, they would see the band bus come back from a tour, and all the kids would come around like the Pied Piper. And, you know, Lewis would call over the ice cream man and buy out the whole truck and invite the kids in. They would watch Westerns on the TV down there and in the living room. And that's really kind of what kept him in this neighborhood. So, of course, these days, his most iconic song is What a Wonderful World. And people are always asking, what is the inspiration? What was he thinking about? And the answer is this neighborhood in Corona, Queens.
So, Wonderful World. There's a zillion people dug that tune the way I did it when I felt it. Because there's so much in Wonderful World that brings me back to my neighborhood where I live in Corona, New York. Of course, Long Island, everybody know where that is. And Lucille and I, ever since we married, we've been right there in that block. And everybody keeps their little homes up like we do. And it's just like one big family. I saw three generations come up in that block. Mm-hmm. And they're all with their children, grandchildren. They come back to see Uncle Satchmo and Aunt Lucille. That's why I say, I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I'm looking at all the kids' faces. And I got pictures of them when they was 5, 6, 7 years old. And it is a wonderful one.
Yeah, so that song is his love letter to Corona. It's pretty beautiful. And one final clip. This is from August 1970, less than a year before he passed away. It's him sitting behind his desk, kind of summing up his entire life. We call it his philosophy of life.
That's my story, folks. I guess I'm stuck with it. I usually say nice things also about human beings if they deserve it. I never want to be any more than I am. And what I don't have, I don't need it in it. I've always loved and I always lived a normal life, which I appreciate very much. And I've always loved everybody, still do.
Yeah, so that's the way that's everything.
That's so simple.
Secret of life.
So beautiful.
So that's where the tour of the Armstrong House ends. But just to catch up on the history, yes, that was August 1970. Lewis passes away in July of 71, July 6, 1971. As I mentioned downstairs, Lucille immediately has this vision. I'm going to leave the house to the city of New York. A year or two later, she's talking about, I'm going to open up a memorial museum. I have all of Louis' things. I've got to get them all preserved. And so she passed away in 1983. And she did, as told, she left the house to the city of New York. And the city of New York said, well, who's going to run this? And so they kicked it over to the Department of Cultural Affairs. And the Department of Cultural Affairs, along with the Armstrong Estate, they chose Queens College nearby in Flushing to administer it. So the first order of business, all of the archival materials, Lewis's tapes, collages, trumpets, writings, were all taken out, brought to Queens College, and the Lewis Armstrong Archives opened in 1994. And so the man who opened it, his name was Michael Cogswell. He was hired as the archivist. Then in 1995, he was made the director of the Armstrong House. And so he oversaw a $1.8 million restoration to turn this into a museum. So this month is actually our 20th anniversary. We opened October 15, 2003. And so we've welcomed tens of thousands of people from around the world since then. But you've come on the right time, because in 1998, there was an abandoned lot across the street. And Michael had the vision. He's like, that lot might be important someday. And so the Armstrong Estate, the Lewis Armstrong Educational Foundation, they paid for it. And it was just an empty lot for years and years. And finally, in the early 2000s, Michael started talking, you know, I think that could be a visitor center one day. And that could be the new home of the archive, exhibition space, the whole thing. Years went by. Michael spearheaded the raising of about $26 million. And every delay imaginable just plagued that building. There was a zoning variance. There was obviously a global pandemic. Sadly, Michael, who opened the archives, opened the house, and got that almost to the finish line, he passed away in 2020. Jerry Chazen, who was the father-in-law of our mutual friend Larry Miller, he was a big supporter of the mission. He passed away last year. So it's been tough because it's been so long. I was hired in 2009 and told, oh, the building should be open 2011, 2012. So it took a long time. We would not be here without Michael, without Jerry, without a million people who got us to this point. But coincidentally, on July 6th, 2023, 52 years to the day that Louis Armstrong passed away, we opened up the Louis Armstrong Center. And so if you want, let's walk across the street and I'll show you around.
We'll do that. Yep.
We'll be right back with more of the Taking a Walk podcast.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, we are going to give women meaningful beauty. And I said, that's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life.
Meaningful Beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Welcome back to the Taking a Walk podcast.
So this is it. This is the building 25 years in the making. And the first thing that hits you when you walk into Louis Armstrong Center is this beautiful mural of Louis and Lucille with the Great Sphinx of Giza in 1961. And our curator, the great pianist and composer Jason Moran, he called the exhibit Here to Stay and chose this image. And I think it's perfect because, you know, this guy, you know, conquered the world. And here he is with one of the seven wonders of the world playing his trumpet. But when he wanted to come home, this is where he came. So, you know, it's the two experiences. We've got the new building, state-of-the-art, all that stuff. But then right across the street, the down-home house that, you know, he called his own for the last 28 years of his life.
She's looking at him with such admiration.
Oh, yeah.
And love.
She was his biggest fan. Yeah. So right through this way over here, perfect, and La Vie en Rose starts playing as we're talking about Louis and Lucille's love. But this is the exhibit area. And so this is something that we were never able to do in the house, where we were just kind of stuck with the house there. And so as we were talking about what a wonderful world, right when you walk in, you got the gold record, which actually came out in the late 80s at a time when they gave out the gold record, the gold CD, and the gold cassette. Yep. But then a six-page letter, actually more of a manuscript that Louis wrote towards the end of his life called Our Neighborhood. And it's just like a love letter to Corona, saying, you know, how they lived here for 29 years. We've been living in the house. We've seen just about three generations come up on this particular block, 107th Street between 34th and 37th Avenue. And he goes on and on about getting Chinese food at the Dragon Seed restaurant, his Cadillac car oozing out of the driveway, their schnauzers, trumpet and trinket. And he writes, you know, when the two of them start barking together, oh boy, what a duet. So that's the first thing that's, you know, we got the Sphinx in Egypt on the other side, but then Corona on this side. And then our curator, I mentioned Jason Moran, he had to go through the entire archives and tell a story. And so he chose to go with four main themes. So there's four cylindrical cases. The first case is roots. And so this is Armstrong in New Orleans. We have these tinted portraits of Lewis with his mother and his sister when he was about 18 years old. Lewis's father, Willie. The crazy part is these were hanging in Lewis's sister's home up until the early 1970s. And we have an interview with Lewis's sister in which she goes, yeah. She said, I just brought those paintings up to Lucille on July 4th. She wants to put them in a museum. And so, again, Lucille's foresight, they didn't make it into the museum until 50 years later, but at least they ended up in Queens. But we have Joe King Oliver, who was Lewis's big mentor. His wife Lil is in that photo. His second wife Lil, she was really the architect of his career. The Waif's home, which is where he learned how to play. It was like an orphanage. You know, we have a photo of Lewis annotated. We have a brick from the Waif's home. But also his adopted son, Clarence. And then a photograph of Lewis on the riverboats, which was kind of his music education school. You know, he was not able to go to college or Berkeley or study jazz, but three seasons on the riverboats really sharpened him as a reader and performer and everything else. And then each one of the cases has about a 10-minute video with lots of archival footage and narration and the whole thing. The next case, I mean, this is kind of the main event here, tools. The tools of the trade here, and of course, the first thing that hits you in the middle is Lewis's trumpet. Now, we have seven trumpets. Oh, and there's Louis Armstrong Lipsav.
Yeah.
from Franz Schwartz, just popped up on the screen. So we have seven trumpets. The one we chose, or Jason chose to put in this case, was actually given to Lewis in 1934 from King George V in England. And the funny part is Lewis played it for years. He was enamored with it. But he was also the most generous soul on the planet. And one day, he was hanging out backstage with Lyman Vunk, the third trumpeter in Charlie Barnett's orchestra. And Vunk was like, man, Pops, that's a beautiful horn. And Lewis said, oh, do you want it? I need a new one. And he gave away the King George trumpet. So it became Lyman Vunk's prized possession. But he passed away in 1991. And a few years later, his wife found us and said, yeah, he wanted you guys to have this. And so she brought it on the subway. She had it in a brown paper bag. She got off on the 7 train, handed it to our director, Michael Cogswell, and said, all right, thanks, and got right back on the subway. So we had it restored, and now it is on display. But we also have a fractured copy signed by Lewis of West End Blues, kind of maybe his most important trumpet solo. Oh, I'm recording an interview, sorry. But yeah, he's upstairs. A fractured copy of West End Blues, which is probably Armstrong's most important trumpet solo of his entire career from 1928. But also, you know, we've got beautiful portraits. Lewis with the Louis Russell Orchestra in California, in London, 1932. One of Lewis's scrapbook pages from 1931, where he would cut out newspaper clippings and everything else. And also a book. This is The Sweet Flypaper Life, signed by Langston Hughes. That was his holiday present to Louis Armstrong in 1955. It says, happy holidays to the Armstrongs. Sincerely, Langston Hughes.
Do you ever think that there were moments he was really dramatically underappreciated during his
career?
Yeah,
oh my goodness. At the time of his passing, he was a household name. Everybody knew him, but I don't think they knew the depth. Because by the 60s, we're looking right at Hello Dolly right now. I mean, Hello Dolly knocked the Beatles off the top of the charts. And so everybody knew the guy who smiled and played the trumpet and sang Hello Dolly and went on the Ed Sullivan Show. They didn't know that he changed the rules of jazz and American popular music. And he changed, I mean, you can name a million great instrumentalists and a million great singers. He's the only guy you could find who completely changed the way people played music on their instruments. And he completely changed the way people sing. And so for one guy to do that, it's unfathomable. But then you throw in, he's the first black pop star. He's knocking down all these barriers for his race. First African-American to get featured billing in a Hollywood film. First African-American to host a nationally sponsored radio show. First African-American jazz musician to publish an autobiography. First African-American entertainer to have in his contract that he wouldn't play a hotel unless he could stay there. He tells off Eisenhower and the government over the situation in Little Rock in 1957. So all those sides of him were really not well known when he passed away. Hello, Dolly, yes. The pop hits, sure. And the funny part is, like, the scholarship around Armstrong and the view of Armstrong doesn't really change until his archives become available. Once Gary Giddens and Ken Burns, Bob O'Mealy, Stanley Crouch, Wynton Marsalis, once his whole generation in the late 80s and 90s can hear Lewis's tapes and read his writings and let him kind of speak for himself, all of a sudden they realize, wait a minute, this guy went through hell. This guy was a civil rights pioneer. This guy basically changed and predicted the next 100 years of American popular music. And he was down home and humble, and he was a global ambassador and everything in between, and a movie star. And so it's been over 50 years since he passed away, and I feel like we're coming to grips with it. We're standing in the Louis Armstrong Center, so we've come pretty far. But my personal feeling is we're still at the beginning. I think 50 years from now, we should make a date to do this again, because I feel like in 50 years, maybe even less, maybe 20 years, but when they say, who are the greats? They're going to say Shakespeare, they're going to say Mozart, they're going to say Louis Armstrong, and no one's going to bat an eye. In 1971, a lot of people would have batted an eye. They would have said, no way the Hello Dolly guy is on that level. But he is on that level, if not more, and I think that's our job, is to get him to his rightful place.
Was he criticized, though, for not being outspoken at the time?
Oh, yeah. No, that was the thing. I mean, he grew up in the Deep South, went through hell, and then, you know, from a recording perspective, he records What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue, which is known as the first protest song in 1929. I mentioned all the barriers he broke down, but by the 50s, when the civil rights era is really gathering steam, you know, he doesn't want to come right out and protest or march or anything. You know, he just, to him, he said, my music will do the talking. And so a lot of people thought he was soft on race. They thought he was just smiling to make white people happy, and he didn't really know what the cause was about. But meanwhile, you know, we have the tapes, we have the manuscripts. He was following everything. He's reading the Chicago Defender, he's reading the Pittsburgh Courier. And if he felt that, you know, if he felt a draft, oh my God, he had that New Orleans toughness. It would come out in a minute that he would just, you know, he could curse up a blue streak, let you know how he felt. But publicly, he didn't really believe in that until Little Rock. You know, he was watching these crowds in September 1957 spit and curse at these 9 African-American students who were supposed to integrate the Little Rock Central High School. And when the reporters asked him, he said, the way they're treating my people in the South, the government can go to hell. And today, I mean, it's one of the cornerstones of what we teach. It's the defining civil rights moment of his career. But at the time, he was criticized. He was criticized. White columnists, of course, were calling for boycotts and all that. But he was criticized by Sammy Davis Jr., by Adam Clayton Powell. They, you know, to them, it was kind of like, you know, too little, too late. You're still playing in the South. You're still playing in front of segregated audiences. And that hurt him deeply until the rest of his life. And so I think we've now properly refocused and reframed him and showed what he went through and what he accomplished and how he used his power and his voice. But in his lifetime, he was not appreciated for that.
What was his take on Vietnam?
He kind of stayed out of that one, but he did, I think, on a deep level, he was not pro-war, that's for sure. But it was an interesting thing. When Vietnam was really raging, he started doing You'll Never Walk Alone, which he had always played on trumpet, but he started singing it. And he would dedicate it every night to all the mothers of all the soldiers fighting in Vietnam.
Oh,
and
beautiful.
So, yeah, and you hear some of his later performances, and they're tearjerkers. And so, yeah, that was him in his own way of, again, he said he was here in the cause of happiness. And so even in a moment like that, he just wanted to provide some warmth, some comfort, you know, to the people who needed it.
Wow,
it's
amazing.
Pretty special. So the third case, we'll go real quick, this is Armstrong on film. People don't know that he was in over 35 films. And so we have some poster of Paris Blues. We have Lewis and Billie Holiday in New Orleans, Lewis and Cabin in the Sky with Ossie Davis and Cicely Tyson and A Man Called Adam. And we also have his Grammy Award, which he got for recording Hello Dolly. And coincidentally, we have a beautiful Gordon Parks photo. I'm sorry. We have a beautiful Chuck Stewart photo of Lewis and Barbara Streisand holding their mutual Grammys, and a few years later they would star in the film Hello Dolly together, where Lewis appears in it for 90 seconds and completely steals the show.
Of course.
And so Jason's fourth and final case was Armstrong, the ambassador. I mean, by the 50s they were calling him Ambassador Satch. And the government was watching. We have his FBI file, which is heavily redacted, but it includes some letters from angry fans who did not like the way he criticized the government. But also some of Armstrong's collages, him with the Pope in Italy, one called an ambassador called Satchmo, the Dave Brubeck album, The Real Ambassadors, which Dave and his wife Iola wrote, all new music for Lewis in 1961. And then his passport, it's his first passport from 1932, where he kind of looks a little, you know, maybe in awe of, you know, he's going overseas for the first time. But his last passport from 1967, I mean, it's basically a publicity photo. You know, he's been around the world, and he's secure in who he is and very confident and ready to go back out and spread some more goodwill. So those four cases we're calling permanent cases, but then Jason also was tasked. Oh, yes.
I had a question sure. about the ambassador piece. So yeah. There was a period where Lewis and others would right. be dispatched yep. abroad to sort of spread
cultural exchange yes. and all that stuff. Yeah.
I mean, it was a bit of U.S. spreading propaganda, wasn't it?
Oh, 100%, because yeah. a lot of these musicians, I mean, Lewis's band, Dizzy Gillespie also did it. Dave Brubeck's band was integrated. You know, they had a hard time in the United States, you know, going down south, especially integrated bands and, you know, the black musicians, you know, who couldn't eat and didn't, you know, this before the Civil Rights Act and everything. But then we're sending them out there as America's, you know, this is our finest culture, this is the best. So there's definitely, you know, two things happening at the same time that aren't quite in concert. But Lewis actually inspired that whole thing. He did a tour of Europe in 1955 that got headline news. Edward R. Murrow followed him around with a camera for CBS News. And then the New York Times followed him around. And they did a Sunday Times cover story in which they said America's secret weapon is a blue note in a minor key, and its most effective ambassador is Louis Satchmo Armstrong. And Adam Clayton Powell read that article, and he went in and said, no, let's make this a program. And so in 1956, they started the Jazz Ambassadors, and Dizzy Gillespie was actually chosen first. Lewis only did one State Department tour. A lot of people think he was an appointed ambassador or that he was always on the government watch, but he only did one tour of Africa in 1960. But without him, I don't think the government would have even, you know, known to send out jazz musicians.
And I love that photo of him with the Pope there.
Yeah, that's a later photo. That's from 1968. And like any musician, you know, Lewis has given the Pope his latest record. But he also looks very reverent. You know, he liked to tell a story about the first time he met the Pope. And the Pope said, do you have any children? And he goes, no, but we're still wailing. But that might have been apocryphal. I'm not sure. And so those four cases, that's the permanent exhibit. But then the temporary exhibit, this was very exciting for us because when Lewis passed away, nobody knew that he was a visual artist, that he was making collages on his reel-to-reel tape boxes. And then after the Lewis Armstrong Archives opened, all of a sudden it became a thing. You know, there's a coffee table book, there was a few exhibitions, but the tapes were very brittle. They really couldn't be exhibited for long periods of time. But finally, shortly before we opened, we received a $200,000 Save America's Treasures grant, and we restored about 80 boxes that were in really bad shape just in time for the opening of the Lewis Armstrong Center. And so you could see his art, and it's fascinating because he is the subject matter of 95%. If it's not him, it's Lucille or somebody he was close to. But we have a collage of Lucille from her dancing days in 1936. You know, he would cut out clippings about his band, photos of him playing the trumpet. This reel over here, this was a Christmas card. This is Lucille and Satchmo. It's a cornet. And he cut out every line and scotch taped it. Lewis with his mother and sister, a black and white version of the color photo. Lewis eating, Lewis singing. You know, and this was how he would occupy his mind after the concert. He was just relentlessly creative. And we have these beautiful photos of him in his den, you know, surrounded by scissors, writing autographs, scotch tape. And then this is a crazy thing. In 2016, the Associated Press did an article about us. And it was the first time a lot of people had found out about us. And we got a call from a guy in Canada who said, I was friends with a piano player. He was the lounge pianist at the Sands in Las Vegas. and he shared a bill. Armstrong was on the main stage, and he would come and hang out with my friend. And he goes, when he left the Sands, he gave him his tape recorder. He goes, my friend died. He goes, but do you want the tape recorder? We said, fine. So we paid for it, and now it's in the museum exhibit case. Louis Armstrong's original tape recorder from 1957. He signed it to this guy, Jimmy Lang, and the original photo, the original autograph. It's all there.
Wonderful. Oh, my God. But, yeah, his mind was always working.
Always working, yeah. He talked about that, you know, because his day-to-day routine, he would wake up, you know, musician hours. He would wake up 3 or 4 o'clock, and the first thing he would do is get a cup of coffee and reach for the trumpet. And he would warm up. He'd play along with the radio. He would just make noises, long tones, whatever. He would call room service if he's on the road or get some spaghetti or something up there. He'd show up at the venue at 7 o'clock. He's still warming up, still warming up. Now he plays 8 to 11 autographs. Now, there's no VIP package or whatever. He had an open door policy. Just come backstage after the show. So the band would go back to the hotel and go to sleep, and he'd be there signing autographs. Now it's midnight. He gets back to the hotel. If there's a hang, if there's a party, he's going to be there. But if there's not, if everybody's sleeping or if they're in the middle of nowhere, he is now revved up. And so that's when a lot of musicians fell into bad habits. But for him, it would be, all right, I'm going to answer my fan mail. I'm going to catalog my tapes. Maybe I'll make a scrapbook. I'll write down some stories. And he's doing that night after night. And if he doesn't do that, we don't have an archive. So the fact that he is, you know, constantly creating, constantly charting his own life, saving these clippings, saving these photographs, you know, all with this kind of self-awareness that this might be important someday. And I don't know if he could have dreamed of where we're standing right now, but it's definitely what he deserves.
Did he fall into any bad habits?
Well, it depends on your definition of bad.
Like nothing in terms of like some of the jazz players of that.
Right, yeah, no. I mean, Armstrong, I mean, the newspaper said it. He kind of helped put marijuana on the map. But he actually got arrested for it in 1931. And so he had to be very discreet. He never really talked about it publicly, but we have some of his private writings and stuff, and he was far ahead of his time. And a lot of the arguments he made to friends about why it should be legal were the same arguments that are getting it legalized today. So he was, again, a trailblazer, you could say, blazing in more ways than one.
I wonder what he would think about the notion that gambling has become legal and right. Marijuana has
I
become
know,
legal.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's his whole upbringing. Yeah, in New Orleans, yeah, gambling, the cops would come and break up the games and all that stuff. So I don't think he could have ever imagined where things were heading. And the last thing to show you here, this is kind of beautiful. As I mentioned, we have the world's largest archives for any single jazz musician. And in 2016, we got a $2.7 million grant from Robert F. Smith's Fund to Foundation to digitize the entire archives. And so these, it's like a big record, as you can see, and there's 8 different screens, and these are all curated stories. So this is, I just chose Louis Armstrong and the Kids of Corona, and you can spend hours here, you know, looking at photos, and each one has a, you know, long caption of Louis and all the kids from the neighborhood. This one has audio of Lucille talking, which... yeah, probably needs the headphones for that. But so this is just one example. But other stories, you know, Armstrong in Africa, Passport to the World, Billie Holiday, Armstrong in Ghana, the neighbors Selma Geraldo, Lose Weight the Satchmo Way, Louis and Duke Ellington, Lucille's life story. And so really, you can come here, and between all the stories on the table, plus all the videos and the monitor, you could spend over an hour in this room and then take the tour of the house and really get the full immersive experience.
Are there any folks that are in the neighborhood that were in the neighborhood then?
Not anymore, but they come back, and that's always beautiful. You know, we actually had the son of Lucille's hairdresser was here on opening day, and then he told me that he was in touch with the brothers who are in the photos, all those front steps photos. They're still, one's in Georgia, I think, and one is in one's in, I want to say, Texas, but we sell coffee mugs with that photo on it. And the brothers were like, hey, can you send us some of those coffee mugs? And so, of course, and we've had people who just show up for tours. It's somewhere, oh yeah, was a 420. Speaking of which, yeah, we've got a photo here. He talks about his
poking the muggles.
Yep. This is the Cannabis Cup, which High Times magazine named him the man of the century. And they gave it posthumously in 1999. This is him getting arrested. So that whole story is there. But yeah, so the kids who were all 5 and 10, they're now in their 50s. And so they keep coming back. And it's really beautiful.
Ricky, let's end with some quotes.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many of them, so.
Well, this whole thing here, you know, this is Ella Fitzgerald on recording with Louis Armstrong. She said, "I was just thrilled. I messed up some records because when we record, I was so busy listening to him and looking at him because of the way he would sing on stage, he would do the same thing while he was recording. I'd forget to come in. I'd be watching him. He was just Louis, just for real. I think that's been one of the great things of all the people I've worked with. They're all real people, no put on." Yeah, James Baldwin writes about Beale Street. Upon hearing Armstrong do the national anthem in 1958, Baldwin responds, "That's the first time I've liked that song." Wow. Yeah, Miles Davis said, "You can't play anything on the horn that Lewis hasn't played." And yeah, we've got a whole, you know, Billie Holiday. She said, "I don't think I'm singing. I feel like I'm playing a horn. I try to improvise like Lester Young, like Louis Armstrong, or somebody else I admire. What comes out is what I feel. I hate straight singing. I have to change a tune to my own way of doing it. That's all I know." Duke Ellington, "He was the epitome of jazz and always will be." Tony Bennett, "The bottom line of any country in the world is what did we contribute to the world? We contributed Louis Armstrong." I mean, if that, that doesn't say it.
Well, the essence of this podcast always comes back to the love of music, the stories behind the music, the people who shaped the music, and this couldn't have been any better of a walk through the house, the museum, and the life of Louis Armstrong.
Thank you, Buzz. It's a special place. I mean, I know I'm immersed in it, but like I said, it's what Louis deserves. And like Jason Moran called the exhibit, you know, we're here to stay. So we hope that people continue to visit, school groups, kids, musicians, international visitors. We're right near the airport. Sometimes we're the first destination when people land at LaGuardia. Sometimes we're the last, right before they board the plane. But we're not going anywhere. So as long as people have any interest in Louis Armstrong or music or the 20th century, culture, race, film, media, we're here to tell that story.
Thank you, Ricky.
Thanks, both.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Taking a Walk podcast. Share this and other episodes with your friends and follow us so you never miss an episode. Taking a Walk is available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air.
Don't waste time on tedious hand washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.